Minnesota City Unleashed, where we decode pet health with some of the best vets in Columbia, South Carolina. I'm your host, Emily White, and today we have Dr. Colin Wolf, a boarded veterinary surgeon with us. Dr. Wolf, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you. So happy to be here.
Of course. And tell us a little bit about yourself and who we have here with you.
Well, this is Walter. Walter is my New Mexican street bred Chihuahua.
Incredible.
He's going to be turning 11 in about a month. And I basically had him since he was a teeny little pup about the size of my foot. And I just adore him. He is very special to me. Many folks may recognize him if they come to our specialty hospital because he quietly sits on the counter in the lobby, just supervising everything and making sure that, you know, everyone's doing their job, that pets are being taken care of. And of course, if anyone gets out of line, he won't hesitate to, you know, get him in order.
Absolutely.
Yes, I acquired him in New Mexico. Let's back up a little bit, though. How did I get to where I'm at? Well, I was born in upstate New York and had a fascination with animals ever since I was a small child, as many veterinarians, I'm sure, will claim. From a very early age, kind of knew that I wanted to work with animals. And developed a passion for working with pets in particular, in part because, they can't advocate for themselves. They can't tell us when they're in pain, when something is wrong. So we need to be astute enough to recognize clinical signs and when things may not be right with them, and to administer the proper treatment. I moved on from my high school training in upstate New York to Cornell University in Ithaca, where I spent 9 years doing both undergrad and veterinary school. Then from there, went on to a rotating internship at the Animal Medical Center in New York City. Was and may still be one of the largest rotating internships in the country. You know, there were 27 of us in my intern class. We kind of ran that hospital at the time. And that was a fantastic experience. From there, I moved on to Dallas, Texas, where I did a surgical specialty internship at the Dallas Veterinary Surgical Center. Had the fantastic opportunity of working with a group of almost 10 surgeons and, you know, really getting a broad exposure to how different surgeons approach cases. Even to this day, I still practice a number of the tips and tricks that I learned from those early days. From that surgical internship, I was accepted into a residency program at Texas A&M University. Spent 3 years in Bryan College Station, Texas. From there, was moved on to Houston, Texas for just a year, and then was recruited to move out to New Mexico, where I spent almost 5 years, and that was when I acquired Walter. I wanted to get back closer to home, right? So I was progressively moving further and further away from the East Coast, where my family was located, and it was time for me to move back, be a little bit closer to home, but not that close.
Right.
I was not prepared to move back up to the northeastern winters.
Distance.
Yeah, well, yes, and a safe distance. Right, right. That's when I made the journey back to the Carolinas. Spent a couple of years in Charlotte doing basically traveling surgery at a number of different veterinary specialty hospitals. I was in Charleston, I was in Hickory, North Carolina, and also here in Columbia doing locum work at CVETS. Well, CVET started, I think around 2018 was when the hospital opened, and Dr. Mike, the owner, and one of my surgical colleagues at the hospital, was overwhelmed, as you might imagine, and certainly needed some assistance. I was happy to sign back on as a full-time staff surgeon at CVETS, and I've been here ever since.
Where was your point during your education where you were like, I want to be a surgeon?
Yeah, I think that was also a realization that I had fairly early on. You know, during my rotating internship, I really had two specialties that I was most interested in, surgery being one of them and cardiology being the other. I was fascinated with how the heart works, the physics behind it. When it came down to it, I like to work with my hands. So that was when I decided to go the route of surgical specialty training.
That's awesome. Yeah. And now you get to work with the cardiologist. So if you ever need your fix, you can just head upstairs.
Yeah, Dr. Kennerly's got us covered.
There you go. Awesome. Mm-hmm. Well, let's get into some of the health stuff.
Sure.
What would you say are your top three pieces of advice for pet owners?
Yeah, I would say one of the most important tips I could give pet owners is to be proactive about preventative care and seeing your primary care veterinarian on a regular basis. Going in for annual or biannual wellness exams allow primary care veterinarians who really are on the front line of mm-hmm. defense for pet health care to identify problems when they are early, right? So we know, and this is on the human side as well, that when we catch a condition later on in the course of disease, it can be a lot more difficult to treat. Certainly can be more difficult to cure if we're talking about a cancerous process. So identifying these problems early and seeking the proper medical attention for them is very important.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yep. I would say in addition to that, getting pet insurance the moment that you acquire your pet. So people don't often, well, some people aren't even aware that pet health insurance exists. But even those that are, you know, have the mindset that, probably not going to need
sure.
it. Or maybe it seems like it's an unnecessary expense. But that all changes when an accident happens with your pet that you didn't expect. Or, you know, they're diagnosed with a condition that you couldn't have predicted.
Sure.
You know, this happens in us all the time, right? And that's why we all have health insurance. But in pets, only about 3% of pets in the U.S. are insured. That differs over in Europe, where in the U.K., I believe around 30% or
wow.
so of the pet population there is insured, and even in places like Sweden, where it's up to 90% of pets are insured there. But it's very important to have this pet insurance so that people aren't confronted with a difficult financial decision about what they can afford for their pet's care. And it certainly makes specialty care, which tends to be expensive for most folks, much more affordable.
Absolutely. And there's, I've learned since, you know, being at CVETS that there's not just like Trupanion, which is a specific for pets, but like my Progressive policy offers it.
Correct.
So you can just check and bundle up with the rest of your stuff.
Yeah. So in fact, I brought in an article written by one of my clients in the Boykin Spaniel Society, and we can share this with a close-up shot later on. But this is about a beloved patient of mine, Branch, who... Well, Branch is about an 8-year-old Boykin Spaniel who jumped from a 2-story height in a home and landed on concrete and
goodness.
Sustained multiple injuries, basically had dislocated both of her wrists as well as her hip. And, you know, she went through multiple surgeries and, you know, her very dedicated owners spent a heck of a lot of money to get her put back together again. And I'm happy to report that she's, you know, pretty well back to a functional state now. But the article that her pet owner wrote was basically advocating for folks to get pet insurance, right? You know, there's well over a dozen pet insurance companies nowadays. And of course, like any insurance company, you got to read the fine print,
sure.
right? I'm aware of a third-party organization called Policy Advisor, that's PAWLICY, that allows clients to go online and to kind of compare and contrast what the various insurance companies offer so that you can find a plan that's appropriate for you. You know, if you wait to look for this insurance policy after your pet has had a problem, Well, there's a catch there, right? No insurance company is going to cover a pre-existing condition. Sure. So hence the recommendation to get these policies early before your pet is diagnosed with a problem and one that that insurance company can't help you pay for.
Absolutely. Because a lot of times, you know, you're in those emergency situations where it's like, I need to make this decision now.
Correct.
And that's just an extra layer of coverage for you.
It is. It is, for sure.
Absolutely. And what would your third piece of advice be?
Yes. Keep your pet lean and active, right? So, you know, for people, you know, we're all challenged with the task of walking, what, 10,000 steps a day? That's hard for a lot of people.
Is that the goal, 10,000?
Yeah, I believe 10,000.
Oh, no.
Yeah, yeah, it's quite a few steps. And while there isn't necessarily, you know, a numeric recommendation for pets, you know, certainly if you're walking 10,000 steps and your pet's by your side a good chunk of those steps, well, it's good for them as well, right? About 60% of pets in the United States are considered overweight or obese. And what we know about pets that carry around extra weight is it can exacerbate a lot of their health conditions. We see a lot of patients with orthopedic disease, joint disease, arthritis. You know, we know that carrying around extra weight on joints that hurt makes it more difficult for those pets, right? We also know that it can increase the risk of them developing metabolic disease. It can exacerbate respiratory conditions. So we see pets with a condition called tracheal collapse or brachycephalic obstructive airway syndrome, which basically any brachycephalic or squish-faced breed has some sort of form of that. And any extra weight that puts added stress on their body just makes it that much more difficult for them to do their normal functioning.
Sure.
And we also know that that carrying around extra weight shortens a pet's lifespan. And so keeping them lean and active, you know, helps your pet to live longer and healthier.
Absolutely. And I think something to think about too, especially in dogs and cats, Walter's size is 1 pound for him is a lot.
For sure.
As compared to you or I.
Correct.
So you just have to keep an eye on it. I have a Shih Tzu, a small 15-pound, 14-pound Shih Tzu. And we had the conversation with our primary vet of like, hey, he's a little chunky.
Yeah.
We need to lean him out.
Yeah.
And we were like, what are we doing?
I know,
so,
right.
You know, it's just a matter of cutting their food a little bit, an extra walk a week, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
It's not too hard.
It's not too hard, but, you know, I mean, listen, we like to spoil our pets, right? And, you know, I spoil Walter too, but I think, you know, there are healthy treats you can give them and there are unhealthy treats you can give them. And, you know, even just a little sausage, you may not think it's much, but those calories add up. And like you said, in a small breed dog, you know, a couple of those small treats, you know, could amount to a meal, right?
Right.
So yeah, I, my most favorite recommendation for treats in pets is, fresh green beans, carrots, you know, vegetables, generally avoiding fruits because there are a lot of simple sugars in there and those calories can add up too, but,
oh, that's a good point. I haven't thought about that.
Yeah. But, you know, most pets, at least Walter, loves all of those things.
He'll take it where he can get it.
And those are the treats he gets on the regular.
It's like, I know you guys are talking about
treats. I know. No, he heard
into the mic.
He heard carrots.
That's something my dog will eat, is a carrot, little carrot, and he's good to go.
Yeah.
I've said this before, but, you know, this past year learning all about vet med, I've learned that most issues can be solved by just keeping your pet at a healthy weight.
Yeah, for sure. So. Yep, absolutely.
That was all three, right? We had all three?
Yes, we did. Okay. We did, I believe.
Those are great pieces of advice.
Yeah.
My next question is, what are some of the most common reasons a pet would need surgery? A reason a pet would have to come see Dr. Wolf?
Yes, golly, I think probably the most common reason I will have a pet referred to me is a bum leg, a lameness, particularly of the hind limb. Mm-hmm. So ACL tears in people, we call them cranial cruciate ligament tears in dogs. It's basically synonymous. But it is the most common orthopedic condition that we see in veterinary medicine, in dogs in particular. And it affects all ages, all body sizes, and unlike people where it's predominantly a sports athletic sort of injury, you know, twist your leg playing soccer, skiing, something like that. In dogs, that's more uncommon than just pets having degeneration of the ligament itself. So the ligament is just unhealthy.
Could that be they're born with that?
So there are a number of risk factors that can predispose pets to a rupture of their ACL. But yes, I mean, you know, it's basically in the genetics of many pets. And it's one reason why when a pet develops an ACL injury on one limb that, you know, at least 50% of those pets will develop the same injury on the other limb at some point in their life. One study that looked at a large group of Labrador retrievers, you know, showed that on average it was about a year later that those pets sustained the injury to the opposite limb. But, you know, we see patients that come in that unfortunately have injuries on both of their legs, and those pets can really struggle to get around. So it's very important for pet owners to not necessarily disregard a lameness in their pet. You know, a lot of folks don't think that lameness represents pain, but in the vast majority of cases, pets are favoring the limb because it hurts. And, you know, any situation where, you know, your pet shows you signs of lameness that doesn't resolve within a reasonable period of time, you know, is justification for seeing your primary care veterinarian, who may well diagnose your pet with an injury to their ACL and send pet owners on over to see us at CVETS to discuss surgical treatment of that condition.
Surgical treatment of that would be a TPLO, correct?
So there are a variety of surgical procedures that have been developed for this condition over the years. But yes, probably the most favored procedure nowadays in pets for ACL injuries, at least by specialist surgeons, is the TPLO. But there are other procedures like a TTA, a cranial closing wedge osteotomy, or even the traditional what's called lateral suture or extracapsular repair that involves basically taking a synthetic piece of suture, essentially, and placing it outside of the joint to kind of duplicate the function of that ACL. But what we know about that procedure, which was developed, back I think in the 60s or 70s, and, you know, was done by quite a few surgeons over the years, and even still is in some situations, that it's not quite as effective as some of the more recent procedures at resolving the condition. Right.
So you say resolving the condition. If an animal needs this and goes and gets this one of these procedures done, are they going to be better? Are they going to live a life of not limping anymore?
So yes, the prognosis with surgical treatment for ACL injuries, especially with a procedure like a TPLO, is usually good to excellent. You know, we know that there is, you know, about a 2 to 3 month recovery period. You know, during that period of time, you know, pets will progressively improve their use of the limb. And generally by the 2 month recheck, when we see them back for x-rays to evaluate for healing, I would say, you know, 90% or so of the patients we see, 90 to 95% are, you know, healing well at that point in time. And, you know, many of them are already starting to get back to the activities that they weren't doing just before they had the surgery. We also have at CVETS a rehabilitation service run by Dr. Dunphy and her very sweet assistant, Kaylee. And they do a fantastic job helping to rehabilitate our orthopedic patients. And that's another great way that we can help kind of facilitate the recovery of pets that have sustained these sorts of injuries.
It's a really cool department to have alongside of surgery.
Oh, it's fantastic.
If you were getting, you know, like an ankle surgery or something, you'd probably go see physical therapy afterwards too.
Of course, of course. I mean, that's a common recommendation on the human orthopedic side of things. And, you know, one could argue it's just as important as the surgery itself.
Sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we have that for doggies and kitties.
We do.
We love
it. And it's great.
So what are some other things that would come through your department?
Trauma. Okay. Mm-hmm. So trauma is unfortunately a common thing that we see. Now, trauma encompasses all sorts of issues. I would say probably the most common types of traumatic injuries we see are unfortunately hit by car injuries, mm-hmm. right? So pets still unfortunately escape from their home, their owners, get out, wander, and it only takes an instant for a pet to cross the road and to be severely injured as a result of a hit by car accident. And these injuries, if they, don't take the life of the pet, mm-hmm. often cause a lot of trauma. Most commonly, we see what's called pelvic polytrauma. So these pets, will come in and, the pelvis, which is, basically a bony box that is the connection between your spine and your hind limbs. We can see that pelvis, sustain multiple fractures, many of which require surgical repair to stabilize in order to get that animal back to a functional state. We also know that by car injuries can cause soft tissue, a lot of soft tissue trauma, muscle injury. But in addition to that, trauma in the abdominal cavity. Mm-hmm. So we can see urinary tract trauma, ruptured bladders, things like that.
Interesting.
And then it's also important for us to, scan the front half of the animal if it seems like it was just the back half that was hit, because some pets will sustain what's called a diaphragmatic hernia. Basically the diaphragm, which is the muscle in between the chest cavity and the abdominal cavity that is responsible for ventilation and respiration. That thin muscle can become ruptured due to the acute pressure mm-hmm. against the animal, and basically lead to abdominal organs being in the thoracic cavity, and that alone can be a life-threatening problem as well. So, bottom line, these are patients that we need to be thorough about evaluating. And if they have, multiple injuries, it can be quite expensive. Another common trauma case that we see are bite wounds, right? So we see a number of cases on a regular basis, pets that come in that have been attacked, mm. Either by a housemate or by an unknown animal. And so, it's certainly important for pet owners to be aware of strife within the household, right? I've seen a number of cases where, unfortunately, the same pet in the household gets picked on. And that pet will come back, sometimes several times for bite wounds on different parts of the body. And it can force clients to make a tough decision in some situations because it can be difficult to keep pets in the same household separated. But, that's, a situation that maybe you can control. What you can't control are the unknowns with
right.
pets and wild animals around you. And so, I think it's important for folks to, be aware of where your pet is at all times and be aware of where other animals might be.
Mm-hmm.
And if you detect the possibility of an interaction, do your best to de-escalate the situation
sure.
or to remove your pet from that situation. Because, it can be... it can be traumatic for a pet owner as well if they have to get in between mm-hmm. two dogs that are scuffling. And, I've had a number of pet owners that have been bitten themselves trying to break up a fight. So doing your best to avoid being in that situation to begin with, I think, is very important.
Bites along with hit by cars is something that, you can try and mitigate those things by keeping your dog on a leash, right?
Correct.
And like you said, keeping an eye on them, making sure you know where they are at all times,
mm-hmm.
just being aware of your surroundings.
Right.
My husband will get on to me sometimes because I'll take our little dog out and, I'm maybe like on my phone or something and really I need to be paying attention. A car could be coming, a car could, come up on the side of the road where we
mm-hmm.
are, And something that I researched, or didn't really research, I saw in my research when getting our dog, was like birds of prey.
Oh.
We'll look for little angels.
They will. They will.
It's, I can't imagine it's like very common, but still something to think about.
I've heard a few horror stories, right? Some of those pets don't get returned, right?
Right. So
they're acquired by a bird of prey and, you know, they're,
that's it.
You know, yeah, sometimes that's it. Very small dogs, certainly that's something to be aware of.
Great Dane's probably fine.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, I wouldn't worry about, you know, a larger giant breed dog being picked up by a bird, but certainly at the little pups, you got to be aware of that, especially because these birds are, you know, can swoop in at any time. So right.
That's literally what they do to survive.
Yeah.
I think something that goes along with you know, the types of surgeries that you see is, you know, when I picture a surgeon, it's you with your cap on in the OR, in your gown, you know, but you guys also do a lot of stuff like wound care and things of that nature.
Well, and that's part of the reason I bring that up, that, you know, the trauma component of you know, one of the common things that we see. So, you know, yes, there are broken bones, there may be injured muscle, but there are often severe wounds associated with it. And, you know, it can be both crushing injury and also scraping injury. You know, we see pets get their limbs, you know, caught between the car and the road. And as you might imagine, it's like a cheese grater, you know, for lack of a better expression. And, you know, we can see injuries that go all the way down to the bone, and, you know, maybe so severe that unfortunately, we have to amputate limbs sometimes. You know, if we've got severe wounds and we're dedicated to trying to get the pet nurse through it, realize that this wound care can take several weeks to months. And that in some situations, you know, the pet's coming in to see us, you know, once, twice a week for wound management, new bandage dressing application. Sometimes we're doing, you know, stage procedures to try to get the wound reduced in size. In some situations, we have to do grafts or skin flaps to basically borrow skin from another site on the body to patch a large area where that animal has lost tissue. And they can be very frustrating and very expensive for pet owners. We've got, you know, many pet owners that are dedicated to that, and you know, we certainly help that process along.
Absolutely. And it goes back to pet insurance, because you never know.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Correct. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we've kind of covered this as we've talked about the surgeries, but what are like some things that come to mind when you think about how pet owners can prevent unnecessary surgeries?
Yes. So like you said, keeping your pet leashed and confined, right? So if your pet has access to the outdoors, having a fenced in yard, right? Making sure that fenced in yard doesn't have an open gate. I think another important one is when you're traveling in a vehicle with a pet. So I don't see it as much here, but I've seen it at other places that I've practiced, where folks will travel around with their, you know, Labrador or other large breed dog in the back of the pickup truck. They're basically back there loose, right? And all it takes is that pet to see something that they want to get to. And these pets don't think about this, right? It's an instantaneous reaction. There's a squirrel there. There's another dog there. Well, I may just have to jump out of this truck to go get them. And so I've seen a number of nasty injuries that have occurred with that. I think also, you know, even being aware of, you know, your pet being, you know, standing on the door ledge, peering out the window, you know, taking in the air. Just make sure that window is closed enough for that pet not to be able to jump out if the you know, the urge should strike them. And ideally, it's even best to have them contained in some sort of, you know, a carrier or even a crate, right, in the car. I've had a few patients in the past that have been in car accidents and, you know, have been tossed from the car and, you know, sure. I mean, being in any car accident, whether you're, you know, strapped in, or loose, you can get severely injured. But certainly, being in a confined environment, having a seatbelt on, and there are ways that you can buckle pets in, believe it or not, can help reduce the injuries that they sustain in those sorts of accidents.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You kind of, how I think about it is, with a child, right? You child-proof your home
right. When
you're expecting a baby.
Mm-hmm.
So when you assume the responsibility of another life, being your pet,
mm-hmm.
you need to pet-proof your life to make sure.
It's true.
That,
it's true. Yeah, and I mean, you know, these are all, you know, people don't, you know, think about these things all the time, right? Especially if they're a new pet owner. And I think it's part of the reason why, you know, going back to seeing your primary care veterinarian, you know, that's often a discussion that is had, you know, early on in life. But also, you know, do your due diligence, do your research, because there are a lot of tools that help pet owners keep their pets safe. I would say another thing about pet-proofing your home pertains to foreign bodies. So I didn't mention this earlier, but one of the most common reasons that I will operate a pet is a foreign body that they have ingested, right? Now, this can be everything from a chew toy that you intentionally gave them to a piece of clothing that mm-hmm. you did not intend for them to ingest, to a peach pit. That's a common one that mm-hmm. we see, believe it or not. And a corn cob.
Summertime.
Seems silly, but that is, listen, a small piece of a corn cob, very tasty for dogs, and just the right size to wedge into the small intestine. And once it's there, cause a mechanical obstruction. And then there are other types of foreign bodies, like plant material, that's not necessarily ingested, but can basically be acquired by a pet just in their environment, mm-hmm. you know? It'd be like you or I walking in a forest and getting a pricker, you know, or hitting a thorn. Sometimes those thorns break off, right? And, you know, can create, you know, a lot of pain and an infection at that site. And an interesting thing we see in dogs is something called migrating foreign bodies. And it's often plant material. And what's interesting about these plants, and I brought one for show and tell. This here is a grass on, and you can see it's, you know, it's almost designed like a fish hook to some degree, where there are barbs that basically prevent it from going backwards, right? So it's designed to keep moving forward mm-hmm. without going backwards. And they have an uncanny ability to just keep moving throughout the body.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, we can see these this plant material basically land itself anywhere. Sometimes it's in the oral cavity, right? So pets ingest these things in their environment and, you know, they get hooked in the oral mucosa. And once that happens, it keeps moving. And I've got a patient that I actually... will be operating tomorrow that I suspect had one of these very plant foreign bodies basically enter the oral cavity and get lodged at the base of that pup's skull.
Oh, my goodness.
And it's been dealing with basically recurrent infection in the back of its throat. So we're going to try to go in and find it and get it removed. And interesting story about this particular grass on was that was removed from the middle ear of a dog. All I can assume is that this piece of plant material found its way right into, you know, the animal's ear opening and basically kept moving internally, penetrated the eardrum, and then basically found a very comfortable home in the middle ear, which is, you know, basically a little bony balloon at the base of the skull. It certainly wasn't going to go anywhere until I removed it. And then I had another patient, and this was kind of the craziest story I have about migrating foreign bodies, where I removed not one but two grass-ons from the bladder of a female cat. all I can assume is that it found its way through that animal's external genitalia, okay, and basically moved its way up through the urethra and into the bladder. And it wasn't just one, it was two of them.
Wow.
Yeah. That was a shocking, shocking moment.
Can you see these on imaging? Like, do they show up on an x-ray? How do you know what you're dealing with?
Well, you're not likely to see them on an x-ray. You might be able to see them on an abdominal ultrasound, depending on the location. You know, very often what we see are abnormal pockets of fluid, right? So the body identifies this as a piece of foreign material. Often there's bacteria associated with it. So it stimulates a very aggressive inflammatory response in the body. The body wants to wall it off, keep it contained, and it also wants to get rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so ultrasound can be valuable for identifying fluid pockets. And, you know, sometimes you just gotta, you know, surmise that, well, this doesn't belong here based on the nature of the fluid, especially if it's a purulent fluid, with a lot of neutrophils. Or even sometimes we'll see microscopic, plant material in there as well that can indicate that, oh, there's probably something there that the body's trying to digest. A CAT scan will sometimes show you. It's not often that we get a smoking gun on mm-hmm. diagnostic imaging. I think, you know, a lot of times we kind of have to put it together and infer that that's going on. And then it comes down to finding the needle in a haystack. Some of these pets have to undergo multiple surgeries if we're unable to locate it. I've had a number of cases where there was that eureka moment where you actually found that piece of plant material.
Aha.
And you're like, got it. And then you're able to finally resolve that issue for that pet.
Wow. I bet that's a good feeling.
Oh, it is. Very rewarding. I remember just last year, I had a Boston Terrier who had basically chronic rhinitis, inflammation in the nasal cavity, and we just couldn't figure out what was going on. And we ended up doing some imaging and found that there was basically this wound tract that more or less led us to this, you know, small little blade of grass.
Oh, my goodness.
That found its way up in the nasal cavity and then...
Left a trail. But once you took that out, I mean, the body heals itself, right?
Yes. Yep. Wow. Yep. That resolved that issue for that pet.
That's awesome.
Very rewarding.
So, Dr. Wolf.
Yes.
What are some common misconceptions about veterinary surgery?
Well, I guess, you know, some folks don't even know that we exist. Right. Now, this is happening less and less nowadays because, you know, pet owners are becoming more familiar with the availability of specialty care and veterinary medicine. But, you know, even just 10 years ago, I would, you know, not uncommonly hear from clients say to me, golly, I didn't even know that you existed. And that, you know, specialty surgery was available for my pet. I think what folks need to realize is, you know, seeing your primary care veterinarian is critical, right? That's, like I said earlier, the first line of defense for identifying problems. But then when you identify problems that may need special attention, may need special technology, or someone that's had advanced training that, you know, many general practitioners don't necessarily go through, can refer you to someone that may be better able to address your pet's issue. A lot of facilities don't have the technology like an ultrasound, a CT, CAT scan unit, MRI, fluoroscopy, or arthroscopy, laparoscopy. I mean, the list goes on and on about the technology we have available to us.
So there's tons of things available that people don't even know about.
Correct. Yeah. I would say one of the neatest things that that we've started using in veterinary medicine is this concept of 3D printing, right? Like 3D printing's all over the place nowadays, and it's amazing the things that we can print now. I have this little show and tell item that I brought. So this here is a 3D print of a cat's forelimb. Okay, this here is the elbow joint right here.
Okay.
And then we've got the radius and the ulna. And of course, this is the cat's paw. And this was a cat that has sustained a fracture of its forearm as a kitten, and was not treated for that, basically healed in an abnormal manner, developed what we call an angular limb deformity.
Okay.
We have the ability now to do a CAT scan of that pet and then send those images to a 3D printer that can then basically manufacture a model of that animal's limb that we can use to plan that pet's surgery. And so in this particular pet, I had this printout done, and not on this particular model, but one at the time, I had basically done the surgery on the 3D model and had pre-contoured the surgical implants so that when we actually finally took that pet to surgery, it was straightforward, right?
Wow.
We had done thorough planning in advance, and it made the process that much more smooth. And so, we've got a lot of neat things that we can do nowadays. This here is a nitinol stent. It's kind of like a Chinese finger trap. But these stents are being used more commonly in veterinary medicine nowadays. Dr. Gallagher with our internal medicine service will place a lot of our stents. These can be placed in the trachea, for example, in pets that have really severe tracheal collapse where medical management has not been successful, and it can be a life-saving procedure for some of these pets. And we can stent really a lot of organs. We can place them in the urethra, in the ureter, and I believe Dr. Gallagher even placed one in a common bile duct just the
wow.
other week. Yeah, so it's fascinating what we have available to us in veterinary medicine nowadays. And these are not things that you're going to have done at a general practitioner's place, right? These are things that you need to be referred in order to have done. And we're blessed in the specialty side to have all this neat technology available.
So not only does veterinary surgery exist, it's also very advanced.
Correct. Yes. I mean, I would go so far as to say, we pride ourselves on being able to care for pets the way we would be cared for on the human side of things. And that's a great thing.
Absolutely. Cool. All right. Well, I want to hear a couple of your fun stories.
Oh, a couple of fun stories.
A couple of fun, maybe a little scary.
Oh, scary stories.
What is the scariest thing that's ever happened to you as a veterinary surgeon?
Yes. Well, the scariest thing that happened to me was the Black Death, the bubonic plague, right? So this, I know, seems a little silly and crazy because...
Medieval, one might say.
Yes, it does seem medieval. Well, a lot of people don't know that it's still endemic in various locations throughout the world, but in the United States, in particular in the Southwest. So as you know from what I discussed earlier, I was in New Mexico for about 5 years, and New Mexico happens to be the most commonly reported state to have human and pet infections with the bubonic plague. It's endemic in the rodent population there, prairie dogs being kind of the poster child for carrying this bacterial disease, and it's transmitted through flea bites.
Okay.
And contact with animals that have the infection as well. We would see pets come in at the hospital I was practicing at there from time to time with enlarged lymph nodes, sometimes wounds, lethargy, fever, malaise. And, we go through the course of our day and we're not always thinking about, could this animal have something that could harm me, right?
Right.
I treated this animal, didn't really have it on my radar all that much that this animal might have had the plague until I, within a week or so of seeing that patient, started to, feel quite ill. And it most significantly manifested with intense pain in my armpits. And I'll never forget the moment that I lifted up my arms and looked in the mirror and saw these grape-like swellings.
Oh my gosh.
And I'm just like, okay.
Something is up.
Something is wrong. Yes. And I assumed, these are my lymph nodes, but I didn't know that mm-hmm. these were actually buboes, right? These are what the buboes are. These are the enlarged painful lymph nodes that people will develop with the condition. And so, you know, it got to the point where I was so painful that I really could not lower my arms beyond this level. And that was when I was like, okay, I need to seek medical attention. Went into the hospital, had an aspirate, a needle aspirate of my lymph nodes done, and was diagnosed with the plague. Was hospitalized for 2 days, was on some pretty intense antibiotic therapy, and fortunately recovered from that fully. It's certainly a crazy story and a scary one at that.
Oh my goodness.
Mm-hmm.
I was weirdly aware that it was still around, was not aware that humans could catch it, was also not aware that you could be cured from it.
Your doctors
didn't wear big crow masks, right?
No, they didn't. But I know what you're talking about. Was that the witch doctor
or something like that? It'd be an incredible Halloween costume for you.
It really would. but it's funny. A couple of my good friends bought me a mug that had that witch doctor on it, and I even have a shirt actually to this day that says I survived the plague. Yes.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I bet that was scary though at the time.
Yeah, of course it
was. We look back and laugh, but.
Yeah. Yeah. No, of course it was scary. You know, anything requiring hospitalization is scary first and foremost. And then when you hear that it's the bubonic plague, of course you think, well, this is real scary, right?
This is it.
Hundreds of thousands of people, lives were claimed with, you know, and that was, you know, granted because there wasn't antibiotic therapy back then. So fortunately we have these medications available to us nowadays that allow us to treat these conditions and cure them, but scary nevertheless.
Did the doctors, when you went to the hospital, I assume since it's a thing there, they were kind of familiar with, I feel like if you did that here, they would be like, I have no idea what's going on.
For sure. Yes. Well, and in fact, I did see an infectious disease specialist. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, in that area, it's certainly a well-recognized issue and one that's, you know, considered reportable. And so, you know, yes, they ran a battery of tests and cultures and so on and so forth, but that was ultimately the diagnosis that was landed on.
Wow.
And it actually part of what allowed them to make that diagnosis even before I was actually confirmed on the testing was the fact that this patient that I had worked with just a week or so prior, we had tested for the plague and it had come back positive. And so we kind of put two and two together. Right. Okay, well, this animal was diagnosed with it. I had examined and treated this animal. So that kind of, that allows us to come to that conclusion.
Oof. Mm. Well, with that being said, your scariest moment, what would you say is one of your most memorable experiences being a veterinarian and a veterinary surgeon?
Yeah. A couple of great, great stories, involving wildlife. I had the privilege of treating a black bear cub who was hit by a car in New Mexico, and this black bear cub sustained an elbow fracture. And the group that was, you know, basically treating and trying to rescue this black bear cub basically told me, listen, if you can fix this and get this animal back to a completely functional state, we can release it back into the environment and it will survive and do well. Anything less than that, and unfortunately, we probably need to euthanize it, because if you send a debilitated bear into the environment, well, listen, it's not going to be able to survive, right? It's not going to be able to catch prey. It might become prey itself. And so, you know, that was, a serious task that I was posed with. I'm happy to report that, the elbow fracture surgery went very well. And then I was getting, you know, updates on a weekly, monthly basis, and saw this black bear cub grow into an adult and saw how it was functioning normally. And, you know, it was a real treat when they notified me that they finally released it back into the environment. And so, that was a very rewarding experience.
It's really neat.
Yeah. Another experience that was rewarding was testifying in front of the state legislature in New Mexico. So wild coyotes are there and can be nuisances to livestock and to pets. And I saw plenty of pets that had sustained coyote attacks. Mm. And, you know, some of them don't survive those attacks. But I had also seen some pets that had been caught in foothold traps that were intended for coyotes. And, well, these foothold traps are fairly cruel, all right? And so an animal gets caught in one of these traps and, you know, it can really maim them. Mm. It can cause injuries to that limb that may not allow us to preserve that leg. And in fact, one of the pets that I had seen that had been caught in one of these traps, you know, had to have their limb amputated as a result of it. And so, you know, it became kind of a personal thing for me. And, you know, that, you know, listen, we should not have pets that are encountering these traps in the environment. People are just out walking on a trail. And we probably shouldn't be doing this to wild animals either. There's got to be a better way. And so I had the privilege of being asked to go testify in front of the legislature about my experiences with these traps. And listen, it was a long push, but eventually they did become banned. But that was also a very rewarding experience.
That's awesome. Yeah. Something you're really passionate about. And you can provide that firsthand experience.
Exactly.
Of like, hey, this is what's happening. Mm-hmm. This is what you're... And to think too, you know, I didn't think about, yes, it's awful for the pets who encounter it, but that's not a very humane way to get rid of the coyote population.
Of course
either.
Not. No, of course not. And, you know, it oftentimes doesn't kill them. It just maims them. Right. So, yeah, I mean, there's nothing humane about it.
Yeah. Well, good for you. Yeah, I'm glad you did that.
Yeah.
Okay. My favorite question to ask veterinary mm-hmm. surgeons.
Okay.
What is the weirdest thing you've ever encountered in a foreign body surgery?
Oh, the weirdest thing. I think by far the weirdest thing is a cast of Gorilla Glue. So this seems like something silly to most people, but dogs find Gorilla Glue very tasty. I had a patient that got a hold of a bottle of Gorilla Glue and basically ingested the entire contents. And if you've ever used Gorilla Glue, you know that once it hits water, it expands remarkably beyond its natural volume. And, you know, this animal ingested this Gorilla Glue, got into its stomach, and basically expanded and created a cast of this animal's stomach, but also basically caused an obstruction, right? So this was a situation where we took x-rays, the stomach was markedly distended, and, you know, you could see this concretion in the center, and of course there was the history of the animal ingesting Gorilla Glue. Okay, we know what we got to do. We got to go in surgically. And so, you know, unlike other foreign bodies where we can sometimes make smaller incisions to get them extracted, you know, in this situation, you know, this is a pretty hard cast of glue. And so we had to basically do an incision across the entire length of the stomach in order to get this, you know, cast removed. I tried to save it, but it kind of crumbled and it was a little bit gross. But nevertheless made for a very memorable foreign body surgery.
So since the dog's insides are moist and wet, did it just come off the walls? Like it didn't stick?
I mean, so it was kind of, you know, I guess it didn't really stick. It was just a cast of it. But I mean, you know, the stomach has, you know, what's called rugal folds and small little nooks and crannies. And yeah, I mean, it basically expanded to every nook and cranny that it could.
Made like a mold of the stomach.
It's exactly what it did. It's exactly what it did. Yeah. Fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Any other wild foreign body?
Yeah. Well, so the other foreign body, not necessarily an unusual one, but the story was a bit comical. and this was a pair of women's underwear. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a common foreign body
we
see in dogs. Yes. Yes. Men's underwear too. but the funny part of the story was not that it was women's underwear, but that it was women's underwear that belonged to someone other than the pet owner's wife.
Ooh.
Awkward. Ooh.
So in that situation, you just kind of have to say,
hey, listen, I'm not here to counsel. I'm not here to mediate. I'm just here to give you back the underwear.
This is what we found. Mm-hmm. I'm leaving the room.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Work this out amongst yourselves.
Exactly. Yeah. No, it was one of those things where, you know, I basically had to leave the room because it got contentious.
Oh,
contentious,
man.
Very quickly.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just, mm-hmm. you know. Be careful what your dog's getting into.
For sure.
You know?
For sure. Yeah, yeah. And keep an eye on your underwear, especially if they don't belong to...
the people in your household.
Correct. Correct. Otherwise, you could get busted.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Yeah. Ooh, well, on that note, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
This was really insightful, and we appreciate, you know, letting people know what a veterinary surgeon is and what that looks like for you. And yeah, it was great having you.
Oh, I've enjoyed myself very much. Thank you for having me.
Awesome. Well, until next time, give your pets an extra pet for us. And thank you for joining us on Soda City Unleashed.